right, everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Philip Drew, Administrator, and I'm joined on the phone by Jane Lozano, otherwise known as Jane the Math Teacher.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you, Philip.
So, anyways, when I was a kid, I hated government school, and they didn't like me too much either. And I ended up going to this little private school, only because I was lucky enough that my dad could afford to spend my college money on my high school. And so I went to this little private school where Jane was my math teacher. And after I graduated from that little private school, Jane and all the cool teachers from the school that I went to all quit and went and made their own school called the Griffin School.
Yes,
so,
we did.
Why don't you tell us all about the Griffin School? How long have you guys been open, and what's the deal with you guys?
Well, when we decided to start the school, I think we had the idea that we could do some of the same cool things that you can do in a really small school, but maybe a little more, I don't know, democratically is not the right word, but a little more fairly. And that even though we'd enjoyed working at the first little private school, the one that we liked, you know, working at, but it was run for profit, and the owner of the school was in it to make money, and so there were aspects of that that we didn't agree with, and one aspect was that all the students had to be able to afford to go there. If you couldn't afford the tuition, you were stuck in the public school. So we tried to think of a way that we could have a similar setup, but have kids come that would increase the diversity of the school, for one thing, by not just having it be a bunch of upper-middle-class kids. And so we decided to try to start the school and make it a nonprofit and try to get some funding, whether we were pretty naive. We thought we could get a bunch of free-type grant money like as seen on TV, and start, you know, having come one, come all. And it turned out to be a lot harder than we thought, but we managed to get it started anyway, just on the goodwill of our landlord downtown, who trusted us to come up. He let us have free rent. Well, not free rent, but he let us have a balloon payment of our first 3 months' rent. He let us move in for nothing, no deposit, no rent, for 90 days until we could get some tuition going. And so we started the school with six full-time teachers, two part-time teachers, and about 13 kids in an office building downtown, and tried to make it look school-like. We had a bunch of books donated by one of the teacher's relatives, since basically his grandfather was old and, you know, moving out of his house, and sent us his entire library, about 1,000 books, by UPS. UPS guy gave us funny looks every day. He brought us these boxes of books for days on end. And we didn't really get any much outside funding initially, but we did, you know, take a very small salary. We'd kind of known what we were getting into, and, you know, that we'd have to tighten our belts for a while. And we made about $300 a month for the first semester that we had the school open, and we're able to pay our rent, and we're able to attract some more students, and we, I guess, had it set up, had the governing, I guess, of the school set up with the teachers that we made decisions on a consensus basis. We practiced that in our all of the aspects of school. In our staff meetings, there was no hierarchical sort of top-down decision-making. We all made decisions based on, you know, and it sometimes took hours to hash them out, which is sort of the bad news of doing things that way. But the good news is that once we came to a decision, everybody was, if not overjoyed with it, at least comfortable with it. And we were able to accept some students that couldn't afford to go to the school. We arrived at the income figure by looking at what the public schools, how they decide who gets free and reduced lunches. We took those same income guidelines just because they were already there, and we just sort of borrowed it and said, okay, if you meet these income guidelines, then you pay a percent of our tuition that is equal to the percent over the poverty level you are. So we had, we've always tried, and from the beginning we've tried to keep it where at least 25% of our student body was on free and reduced, tuition. And
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I was sitting here doodling. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
Anyway, that's how we set up private school for people who can't afford private school aspect of the school. That's how we arrived at that. As far as how we did it, like what specifically do you want to know?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. Well, let's stick with the money thing there for a minute. How many kids that go to your school qualify for the reduced rate?
Right now, I think there are... Let me get this straight now. I think we've got 14 or 15 of our 55 kids. So it's still right at 25% of our kids. We've got about 56 kids now, I think, and I think 14 of them are on tuition assistance, which is exactly 25%. So
well,
we've tried to keep that stable.
Teacher. I'll have to take your word for it.
Huh?
You are Jane, the math teacher. I'll have to.
I am the math teacher. I'm not as involved with the financial aspect as I used to be. When we first started the school, the first 4 years, I guess, I was the co-director of the school, and I retired from that just to be the math teacher because I'd rather teach math and work with kids than have to work with, bookkeeping and grown-ups and parents and stuff like that. It's my preference to just work with the kids, and so that's what I've done. But the last figure that I heard from my coworkers that still do the administrative stuff was that. So that's what I'm going to go with.
I like that. The whole private but nonprofit at the same time.
Yeah, it's a private nonprofit school. When people hear that, they assume we're a charter school, and I have to correct them and say, no, we're not a charter school. We're not affiliated with public school at all. Now, the only thing that we have done, and we sort of debated about doing this, but the one thing that we have done is that we have sought out accreditation. And all that means is that there is some agency that I don't know where they get their paperwork from, but there is an overseeing group of school administrators, I guess they are, from other private schools that set up this accrediting agency, and they go and visit your school and look at what you're doing, and they look at some of your some of your paperwork. By paperwork, I guess your financial structure, to see that you're stable, that you can, got enough income coming in and financial stability that you can afford to pay the rent for the next school year, that kind of thing. They look at credentials of your teaching staff to make sure that everybody's got, college degrees and stuff like that, and they sit in on some classes, they interview some parents, and they do these kinds of things to make sure that you're really teaching what you say you're teaching. You can't, I guess, it would be difficult to go through this process and be just, sitting around whittling sticks and playing, backgammon or something and saying you're teaching, a high school level curriculum. You have to pretty much be doing what it is you say you're doing, or the accreditation process that you have to go through is rigorous enough to where you do have to be covering all the bases, or that they'll probably see through what you're, if you're making it up, they'd probably see through it. But
Well, the kids still get to go on nature walks, don't they?
Oh, yeah. We still get to go on nature walks. And you know, the thing with the accreditation process is they come and visit you for 2 or 3 days, and then they leave for a year, and then they come back for 2 or 3 days, and then they leave for 2 years, and then they come back for 2 days, and then they might leave and not come back again for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. So you just have to renew your accreditation every so often. So basically, we decided to do what it took to get accreditation so that we would obtain a certain amount of, I don't know, authenticity in the community and make it easier for the kids that graduate from our school to get into college. What we found is that when you graduate from a non-accredited school, if you're going to go to some hippy-dippy school, you're going to go to Evergreen up in Washington or what's another one, Antioch in Ohio, there's some schools in this country that are not concerned with, you know, the formalities of education. They do look at the student and what the student's capable of doing, maybe, but they don't necessarily, you know, they're not as concerned with a piece of paper in a frame or a plaque or something like that. But most colleges do want to see that the school that the kid that they're deciding whether to admit or not to college is from a, you know, has done some sort of standard high school curriculum. By standard, I mean it's not just sitting at home and watching C-SPAN, and so the kid might, you know what's going on and or know what the government decides to show them on TV, but might not know how to do algebra, or if you know, when a college is taking a risk on a kid to, you know, decide to let them in or not, I think they want to know that they've got at least enough of a well-rounded education that they're capable of independent thought. So it's a lot easier for most colleges to look at the student not only as, you know, by what they present of themselves in their application and their interviews, but also to, you know, sort of rely on the fact that if a school that sends them a transcript that says they've taken, you know, algebra and history and English and chemistry and biology and geometry and these things, that they can sort of have a framework to look at, say, well, this school is accredited by an agency that accredits other schools that from whom we've accepted students before, so we can pretty much bank on the fact that these kids have taken this course load, whereas if you're just sort of a outlier school and not affiliated with any kind of organizational structure, it's a lot more fun for the kids and the teachers if you do that, but it's a lot harder for them to get accepted into colleges. So we, at some point in our evolution, we had to make a decision whether we were going to stay completely outside the system, completely outside any kind of external administrative framework, and just completely do what it was we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it, or if we could manage to keep a foot on both sides of this line and, on the one hand, do, you know, have the school be the way we wanted to do it with, you know, field trips and cancel classes if we want to take the kids downtown to see a peace rally, or a, you know, the kids like to go to anti-death penalty rallies and that kind of thing. If we want to be able to keep doing that, and also have some sort of, like I say, an external framework for people to have a frame of reference, such as accreditation with a school accrediting agency, and we think we've been able to do that. There's just a few compromises we have to make in the way of sort of filing paperwork. What I'm doing right now, I'm sitting here writing lesson plans that I have to turn in because we have to keep them in a book for when the accreditors come next year to see what we've done, and I have to have this paperwork on file. Now, whether I actually did what it is I writing down on the exact day that I wrote down that I did it, I don't know. You know, I know that by the end of the quarter and the end of the semester, my kids were able to do what it is I've said that they were able to do on this paper, but I don't know if they did it exactly on the day that I'm putting down. I'm just sort of filling out paperwork for the fact that we have to have it in a book somewhere. But
to what degree exactly do they have veto power over your curriculum, the accrediting agency guys?
They don't have veto power of our curriculum. The way that we have to structure our curriculum is what we found that colleges like to see. In other words, we used to just have a real loose, loosely structured arts program, just sort of an art class that the art teacher that we had, he'd come and say, oh, what do you feel like doing today, kids? Let's go out and carve some wood, or let's go, you know, sketch with charcoal. And it was pretty loose, and the kids learned some different things, but it wasn't very structured. So at the end of the year, the kids' portfolio might not be very well-rounded. In other words, it might have a lot of one thing and not much of another thing. And what we found when kids would, and we end up with a lot of real arty, farty kind of kids because of the fact that most, and you know, it's hard to, when you generalize, you end up sort of leaving some stuff out, but you kind of have to generalize sometimes in order to give people a picture of what you're trying to talk about. A lot of kids that end up not doing well in public school, the reason they're not doing well in public school is because they're just real creative, and so much so that they just can't line up to walk to the water fountain, and they just can't adhere to a dress code to save their lives. And it's just because they are a little too creative to fit into that kind of structure. And so a lot of those kids that have that attribute of creativity are artistically inclined. And I don't always mean in the fine arts. Sometimes it's journalistic arts or, you know, writing.
Radio,
there you go. But they're artistically creative. And so in order to get these kids into some of the better art schools, we, you know, just through trial and error, we found that these art schools do require that kids have a well-rounded portfolio. You can't just be, it's not usually good enough to be proficient in one medium. They want to see that you can maybe do photography and painting and drawing and some sort of three-dimensional art, like sculpting or ceramics or something like that, you know? And so we've had to get a little more structured and add things to our curriculum a little bit in response to what we've seen colleges want, but not in response to what any accrediting agency came and told us to do. What we found out is that what we already had was perfectly suitable because, you know, I guess our instincts and what we brought with us as a group of teachers were the right things that we needed to have. So all we've had to do is add things as we found out that that colleges would, you know, say, well, does this student applicant have such and such course in their background? And if we had to say no, well, then that was something that we'd try to add or try to remedy. We couldn't add it as a course, we'd send kids to ACC to get dual credit courses. If we have one student that wants to take physics, and that's the only student that semester that wants or needs a physics class, then we'll cut out a little chunk of time in their daily schedule from our school requirements and send them over to ACC and let them take a physics class or a calculus class or something over there. And
well, and for people who are listening on the internet or hear the recorded version of this interview later, ACC
Austin
is Austin Community
College. There you go.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. And so we've tried to just be responsive. You know, it's a very evolutionary type of thing. There's a lot of flux and change because we're always trying to make it better. We're always trying to be responsive to the students and their needs. We try to make them included in the governance of the school. We have a lot of committees that we use to run the school.
Committees made up of students?
committees made up of students, teachers, parents, whatever. It depends on the committee. For instance, the we have a steering committee that decides non-academic policy, and including stuff like how we treat absences and tardies, things like, well, I'll get into that later, but that's an example of how we treat absences and tardies, other non-academic policies. And that steering committee is made up of three students, two teachers, two parents, and one administrator. We have our discipline for the school is carried out by the responsibility committee. And the responsibility committee is made up of two teachers and three students. And notice it's weighted in favor of the students. And it really doesn't have to be, because we don't do things by voting. Again, we do things by consensus. And the consensus process, like I said, it takes a while to hash things out. It takes everybody listening to everyone's concerns and trying to sort of come to the middle and see what the sense of the group is. The way that we arrived at deciding to do consensus process for all of our decision making had to do with one of our founders is a Quaker. And the Quaker group, the Friends meeting, that's how they make decisions. And it can be a pretty, like I say, a long, drawn-out process. We try to cut through some of the lengthy silences that occur in Quaker meetings, but we do everything by consensus. So in the responsibility committee, where even though there's three students and two teachers, if there's an issue that comes up, some student comes before us with some sort of malfeasance that he or she may have committed, if one of the teachers doesn't agree with the other teacher and the three students, we'll sit there and hash it out until we come to something that we can all live with. But usually we, after working together for a month or two, we kind of get a sense of what each other, the lengths to which we can go, and the range of the degree of different consequences and solutions that we can come up with that everybody will agree with. So it gets to be a lot, the process gets to be a lot shorter. We know we get to where we can predict what the group is going to be. What the group is going to find acceptable, so it works out. So that's another committee. One of the committees is the activities committee that decides. We have every other week we have a 2-hour period at the end of the day where we don't have classes and we do some school wide activity, and that might be going down to the student union down at the University of Texas and going bowling. It might mean we go to the park and play capture the flag. It might mean we just get a couple of different videos and watch movies and eat popcorn if it's ugly weather outside. We might go to a museum. We might, just go down to a park and not do something as active. We might have a variety of activities. Some kids might go play basketball. Some kids might sit and play music and play guitars and play drums, and some kids might sit and sketch and draw, and some kids will just sit and play on the playground equipment, even though they're 16, 17 years old. They're still swing and slide and stuff and goof around. So we do these activities every other week, and there's an activities committee with two teachers and three students, again weighted in favor of the students, to help decide what we're going to do twice a month on those activities. We also have a student quality of life committee that is only students that meet without any teachers or any adults present, and they come up with things like we have these dress-up days. I think those are every other week also. We have these dress-up days, and the dress-up days can be, pirate. We've had Pirate Day. We've had 80s Rocker Day. We've actually had Pimps and Hoes Day.
All right.
Yeah, believe it or not, we have. We're going to have, I think the ones coming up this next quarter, Uber Goth Day, Roman Day. So I'm sensing lots of togas there, and I'm going to bring a lot of safety pins in case I need to pin some of them together. Oh, gosh, what are some of the others? Anyway, they're pretty creative.
That sounds like a hell of an education, Jane.
Well, we try to make it fun because that's part of what most of these, like I said, a lot of these kind of goofy artistic types, such as yourself, which, you know, you're not, although you could draw, but your artistic sensibility didn't necessarily take you towards the, you know, what the stereotypical artist type thing you might think of. It is a journalistic type.
Well, you can just call me an outcast. I'm not much of an artist.
Well, no, but I mean, you do have a creative sense in that you've taken your, I guess, interest in sociological and political constructs and beliefs and turned them into a radio show. And that's a media, and media is a form of artistic expression. So, you know, you don't have to draw a lot of connect dots with lines to come up with, you know, you've got some artistic sensibilities. It's just not your stereotypical kind, because even in that, you are sort of an outlier. But anyway, the kids that are like you were and that are like the kids we have now, they just like to have fun, and they just want to, you know, if you can make going to school a little less rigid and a little more fun, if you can call your teacher by the first name, if you can get away with saying what you think in class and not be afraid to voice your opinions, even when they're different. We've got even though it's a pretty liberal student body and a pretty liberal group of teachers, occasionally we'll get the student that is not liberal, that is way more right than, you know, when I say right, I don't mean like right hand, I mean like right wing, than you would think in a setting like that. And we have one or two kids like that right now, and boy, this one kid that goes to school where I work, he is on the other end, the unpopulated end of every opinion that, you know, most of the kids have. You know, we're talking about the war, we're talking about
what about libertarians? Aren't there any libertarians? Are they all lefties and righties?
I don't know.
I'm sorry,
if any
I'm
of
just
kids,
picking on you. I know that there's no.
I don't know if there's any of the kids anywhere that have their beliefs as well thought out as that. I think most of them are still kind of, you know, pulling in different things, and they don't really know how to categorize it.
Well,
so
you're giving them a good chance to get to the bottom of it all.
Yeah, we have one little girl who is real, 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 real into animal rights. And she's like a seventh degree vegan, you know, nothing with a shadow that she'll eat. And bless her heart, she's very determined and very sincere in her beliefs. And we let her have one of our little assembly periods to talk about her animal rights issue and to educate the rest of us on how strongly she felt about it. And good Lord, she showed, you know, some of these horrible films of animals getting slaughtered in terrible ways in these factory-type situations, factory meat processing-type stuff, and it was pretty horrifying, and animal testing for medical purposes and for cosmetic companies and this and that, and it was hard to look at, it was hard to stomach, and it was right before lunch, and there was a lot of people who couldn't eat afterwards, and I think she, you know, pretty much made her point, but I don't know if she made any vegetarians out of people that weren't already headed that way, but she got to have her time to she got to have time to express herself, and so she's on one end of that spectrum, you know.
I try very hard not to pay attention to films about how the meat I eat is prepared. I don't.
Yeah, because then it's hard to enjoy a nice steak dinner, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. I got my fingers in my ears and my eyes closed for stuff like that.
Yeah, and you know, that's, to me, I mean, that's awfully, I don't know, you wouldn't want, if it were something you felt strongly about, you certainly wouldn't want people to close their ears and not pay attention and say, oh, well, that's okay.
Yeah, but I'm only trying to get them to stop voting for Republicans and Democrats. I'm not trying to ruin their lunch.
Well, she's only trying to get people to stop hurting animals. She's not trying to ruin your lunch. Her premise would be, hey, you can eat all this nice green stuff that, you know, doesn't have to die a horrible death before you eat it, and then you can get into the whole thing of the plant screaming and this and that. But anyway, you know, you don't want to shoot her down. She's very sincere.
Oh, I would have paid attention if I had been in that assembly thing. But on my own time, when I have a choice, I don't want to know a thing about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, and see, I guess the kids would say, well, we didn't have a choice. Those assemblies are required. You made us watch this horrible film, and well, you know, if you got upset, all you got to do is close your eyes, and you know, we do let kids listen to headphones if all else fails, because we got so many kids with ADD and ADHD that if they don't have music plugged into their ears, they can't focus on squat. So, you know, that's another thing they can get away with. They can sit there and have headphones on if while they're doing their work, not while we're trying to lecture or when they're supposed to be listening. Obviously, they can't, you know, listen when they got their ears plugged up with music. But if they're sitting there doing their schoolwork, they can wear headphones and listen to whatever. So
I know that everybody in the audience is sitting there going, damn, I wish I'd gone to a high school like that. Teachers by the
We could dress up like hoes and wear headphones during, you know, classwork. And
you let them smoke?
Huh?
Do you let them smoke?
Well, define let.
Like
during class?
Coerce them into not smoking?
Well, put it this way. The place where we rent the property for the building we have the school in,
uh-huh.
we're not supposed to let them smoke on those grounds. And so we kind of have it where, and we have an open campus for lunch. So the kids can leave, and we also have...
is it a full day of school, or is it half day like it was at the school?
It's full day, and that's one thing that when we were teaching at the school where you graduated from, that was one thing we didn't like about it, in that it was half day, because we didn't feel like we had enough time to teach everything we needed to teach. We felt like there was a lot we had to skip over and not get accomplished because the kids were only there half days.
Hey, what a cop out. You taught math and I had math class every day.
That was the only class that was every day.
Yeah, I know.
If you remember, all the other classes were every other day. So, and you know, if you consider that you're going to school half days and that's only 4 days a week, you know.
Right.
But
Do the kids that go to your school, do they get as good of an education or a better education than they would get going to a government school, you think?
For them, I think it's better. I think if you took a kid that liked where they were going to school, at a public school, a government school, and forcibly took them out and made them go to some, you know, sort of differently structured school, then I think no matter how much you try to shove down their throat, I don't think they're going to like it, and I don't think they're going to get as much out of it. And so even if you might think, oh, well, we're getting to think more deeply about subjects, I don't think you can't make somebody think deeply about something. You can't make that happen. So I think that the kids that want to be in this kind of setting, that they are getting a lot more out of what we're providing for them than they were in their previous school. I think that we're doing more for them than the school where they were previously that they were previously attending. I think we're doing more for them in the setting that we have them in. I think they're more comfortable in that learning environment, and I think they do get a lot more out of it.
Okay, well, you know, I'm a complete kook, and so I don't expect this opinion to necessarily resonate with you so much, but the more I learn about government schools, especially from John Taylor Gatto and Beverly Eatman, both of whom I've interviewed on this show,
right.
I'm horrified with not just, you know, I remember perfectly well that I hated going to school when I went to government school when I was a kid, and you know, I just thought that was the way it was. And what I've learned, especially from John Taylor Gatto, is that they made it like that on purpose. They wanted me to hate it so that I would choose to not be educated, because they count on kiddos not being able to differentiate between hating school and hating education when they just make them one and the same thing. And so I have this, you know, if I could have a magic wish and do like I Dream of Jeannie, I would just abolish all government schools in America all at once. They would just vanish and disappear into the void. And then the American people would be stuck with a bunch of kids all day, and they would have to decide what to do with them. And, you know, in my perfect world, they would all set up schools a lot like yours, where it's private, but it's not necessarily, you know, it's not run for profit. I mean, you guys make your salary or whatever, which I'm sure isn't that much. But the purpose is for educating the kids, and it's, you know, up to the free people in a mode of free exchange to decide how that happens.
Right. Well, you can do. You know, I can't. I don't know. I don't have at my fingertips the amount that a publicly funded, government-funded school spends on one student in a year. I think it's something around $6,000 a year, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it might even be higher than that.
It might be higher than that, and you can do this kind of school for that. We did it for a number of years now. We were working for really teensy little wages, and in order to, I guess, I mean, of the teachers that I work with, I'm trying to think, 1, 2, 3, 4... I think about half of us don't have cars, okay? Now, I'm the exception. I do have a car, and you know what kind of car I drive, but that's because I'm married, and my husband supports my teaching hobby, as he calls it. But we did raise our tuition so that we could, I guess, keep the teachers that we had from, you know, leaving or, you know, having to work two jobs and that kind of thing. But if what you said were to happen, you know, if the public education went away overnight and there's this sort of a void, I guess the only problem I would have with that is the void part. You know, if there were no education happening for a while, I think that would be for a few kids, you know, for that group of kids that were of a real impressionable age and needed to be in school right away, I think there would be a very sort of analogous to anarchy, except and education, you know, no lack of any sort of educational structure. I think that for a period of several years before you could get a lot of this in place, and, you know, I've been doing this with this little private school I've been working with for since 96, so 8 years now. And so there would be a regrettable period of time that there wouldn't be anything happening, and that would be the problem with it. But
right. Well, I don't have magical powers anyway, so.
Well, right, right.
It's still a matter of, you know, it's a slow transition, hopefully.
Yeah, if it could be transitioned that way, and, you know, there was a system in place before the, you know, end of public education as we know it, then, you know, it could be done for about the same amount of money, and especially with the large volume of kids. You know, we're able to do, you know, provide education. We're able to provide education with, you know, for about the same amount of money as public schools spend, but not, you know, on a real small scale. And if you're doing it on a much larger scale, then, you know, you could take that economy of volume. I'm trying to think of the phrase. Economy of scale. Thank you. I knew the scale was in there somewhere. You could take that economy of scale and, you know, do a really good job with the same amount of money. But, again, there would end up being some structure to it. You know, you never realize the framework you need until you get into it. It's like, wait, we need a way to decide this. We need some people to do this, you know. So there would be some sort of external framework. There would be some sort of governance, if you will, of it, but it wouldn't be the government, you see.
Right. Well, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, an association of private schools who go around checking each other's work or something
right.
is perfectly okay as long as there's
right.
no coercion involved.
Right, so I suppose it can happen in a perfect world, but we don't have a perfect world.
All right, now, you brought up economy of scale. That brings up, you know, not just the size of the school, but the size of the classes. We hear most of the faulty, in my view, debate about government schools places most of the blame just on class size. And if only we would give the government more money, then they would hire more teachers and we'd have fewer kids per class and everything would work out just great.
Right.
And I'm sure that's part of it. I don't know that giving more money to the state is ever going to solve that problem, but you guys have taken that lesson to heart, too, about the class size, right?
Yeah, we have. If we get a class that has 10 kids in it, we'll cut it in half. You know, we did that just over the Christmas break. There was one of the world history classes had, I think, 11 kids in it, so we made it to two classes and had a teacher take on an extra section just to keep that class small. You know, if a class gets up to 8 kids, that's about as big as we want to see. And, you know, if it gets much bigger than that, then we'll look at cutting it in half and trying to get a teacher to take another section on. Because it just, I don't know, the way we do things.
What's your dropout rate, Jane?
You know, we had an intern that came and worked with us from UT that did a survey on that, and I, for the life of me, I can't remember. It was less than public school. But it wasn't a lot less, and you'd think it would be a lot less, but I think that one reason that it wasn't as dramatic a difference as you'd think is that the years that this person was looking at were the first, I think the first 5 years we had the school. And when we were first starting the school, we were taking people that this was sort of their last chance. Like, they'd been to a couple of other places, maybe, and this was the last thing they were trying. And, you know, it was a not optimal situation for us in that, you know, we weren't real picky with who we accepted to come to the school. And, you know...
Well, and also, they're paying money for it every month, too, which makes it harder to keep up. You know,
well, that's true. But our dropout rate is less than public school, but it's not dramatically less because of the small period of time that we have to look at. You know, we only have 8 years of history to look at, and the first 5 years of our history, which was about when this intern, I think it was the school social work intern from the University of Texas, it was coming did a study with us. That's all she had to look at, and so, you know, I guess it didn't give a real good picture. But it would be an interesting thing to look at in another 2 or 3 years when we had a better demographic to choose from. When I say better demographic, I mean kids that came here solely because they wanted to, and not just because this is sort of their last thing to try.
Right.
You know.
How are the grades on average compared to government school? Do most of them make A's and B's? And
well, this last semester we have it's pretty interesting. You know, there's a whole debate about the bell curve, and the guy, I can't remember his name, that wrote the very disputed book of study about the bell curve. But we had 13 or 14 kids, I think, on the honor roll, which is mid B's and above, and 17 kids on academic probation, which is if you fail or incomplete two classes. So we've had about a third of our kids on the honor roll and about a third of our kids doing badly, and the other third was in the middle, so go figure.
I wonder how that compares to government school.
You know, I don't know. I know that, for instance, to get into the top 10, you know how they have this whole top 10% rule? In Texas, if you graduate the top 10% of your high school class, you automatically admitted to a state university, for people who aren't familiar with that. But to get into the top 10% in a large suburban high school, such as the school in the district I live in, you have to not just have mostly A's and a few B's. That's not good enough to get in the top 10%. You have to have almost all A's, and you have to be in almost all honors classes. And so those A's are counting as, you know, super A's with the extra grade point. It's hard to get into a top 10% of a large, upwardly mobile type area like where I live. On the other hand, if you know, it depends on the school. It depends on the school district. It depends on the demographics. So I think it'd be hard to sort of say something about any one government school without looking at where it's coming from, you know, looking where it's located, looking at its the quality of education there. And anytime you get into quality of education, you end up looking at these rating systems that the schools set up for themselves with the recognized and exemplary and that kind of thing. So it would be real hard to quantify without accepting certain criteria that are established by the system that you're critical of. You know, like you yourself, that you're fairly critical of government schools, but then in order to rate them or to try to make a decision on how well they're doing or what their grades are like, then you have to kind of go by criteria that they themselves set. So it'd be hard for an outsider to say that.
Right. All right, everybody, you're listening to my interview of Jane Lozano. She is otherwise known as Jane the Math Teacher to me.
And, Jane the Math Teacher, Philip.
And she helps run the Griffin School, or I guess teaches math, used to help run the Griffin School, a private, non-profit high school here in Austin, Texas. Let's see, I was just about to ask you a really good question, but I can't remember what it was.
You want me to, like, fill some airtime while you think of it again?
Yeah, do that.
I could just go off on something totally random. I can't think of anything to randomly go off on, so, okay, it's back to you.
All right, so anyways, man, I'm no good at math, and this poor lady, I probably put through hell trying to get me to figure out a way to pass me through algebra class in high school, and I'm eternally grateful for it.
You actually were pretty good in math. You just said you weren't. You just didn't think you could.
I was all right until I got to geometry, man. All those triangles drove me nuts. I can't stand triangles. I hate triangles. Imagine filling a whole book with nothing but triangles. And then you get to chapter 8, circles. But then you turn the page and there's triangles inside the circles.
Triangles in the circles, exactly.
Triangles outside the circles. It's ridiculous.
Well, the whole thing with I could go into what trigonometry is, but it's all about triangles and circles. And I just love it. I think it's just the coolest puzzle-solving thing in the world, but, you know,
Big difference between you and me. I never took any trig whatsoever, and I would have got a big red F in it if I had.
Maybe not necessarily. Once you saw that, I don't know. If we had a lot of time to sit down and look at it, you might like it.
Yeah, I always wished I could have a little Jane to carry around in my shirt pocket in case...
The pocket Jane.
In case some math questions came up that I couldn't handle.
The pocket Jane.
Yeah. How many places of pie can you name off the top of your head, Jane?
I don't care about the places of pie.
Oh, okay. I was just kidding anyway.
The thing about the places of pie is that if you start talking about places of pie, then you're artificially adding to, when you round it off, you're either adding to it or taking away from it if you chop some of the decimal places off. So
it's better to just leave it at one.
Better to just use the symbol pie and... Everybody knows what that means, so leave pie in your answer.
See, I'm learning new stuff about math all the time, folks.
Leave pie in your answer.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show and telling everybody about the Griffin School. If they want to contact you guys because their young punk kid wants a good education instead of a government one, how would they get a hold of you?
They could call the school. It's area code 512-454-5797. The director of admissions is Danielle Austin, and you could contact her and talk about being admitted. And like I say, we have got some kids into some really good. We advertise ourselves as being college prep. We don't, obviously we can't make kids go to college, but we certainly do try to get them ready for it and try to encourage critical thinking and. We do have a lot of artistically inclined students, and we've got some kids. We've got a kid that graduated last year at Parsons School of Design and is doing very well there. We've got a girl that graduated last year. She's at Chicago Institute of Art and is doing very well there. And so if you've got a very differently themed student that is unhappy in their government school, check us out.
Cool. And what's your guys' website again?
Our website is griffinschool.org.
Griffinschool.org.
That's right.
Killer. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Jane the Math Teacher.
No problem, Philip.
I sure appreciate it.
We'll talk to you soon, man.
All right.
Bye-bye.